Hello, I'm Terrence McNally, and welcome to another newly recorded episode of Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. And I'm going to be speaking today with Adam Hochschild, journalism professor at UC Berkeley, and author most recently of Lessons from a Dark Time and other essays. You can learn more at journalism.berkeley.edu, and once you get there, search for Adam Hochschild, and that's Hochschild. After a three-year hiatus since Trump's Electoral College victory, I've been doing a new interview every other week. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on her book No Is Not Enough, Arlie Hochschild on her book Strangers in Their Own Land and the Stories That Divide Us, Robert Wright on why he's a Buddhist. The show airs as specials on KPFK 90.7 FM in LA and streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn, and podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on Apple Podcasts, iTunes, Podomatic, Google Play, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net. A quick plug for participation. These are organizations that if you want to resist the Trump administration and work toward the healthy and just future we all need and deserve, one is indivisible.us. Indivisible emerged right after the election of 2016 and has at least 5,000 local chapters. They send out an email every week telling you, here's what's on tap for this week, and they're now obviously getting very involved in 2020. Two sites that were for a long time both digital, but since 2016 have been coordinating their work with on-the-grounds grassroots groups more is MoveOn.org. That's one word, MoveOn.org on the national basis, and CourageCampaign.org. Courage Campaign, one word, in California. Two that are very specific. There's a website, Five Calls, the number five and the word calls, fivecalls.org, which tells you sort of the most timely and relevant calls for wherever you are in the country. And then Town Hall Project, one word, townhallproject.com, which tells you when your representatives are visiting their home districts and when you can actually meet them in person and let your feelings be known. And finally, 350.org is probably the biggest global climate action organization, and they are working with Greta Thunberg, who is on her way here from Europe, and they are calling for global strikes for climate action on the 20th and 27th of September, and that's 350.org. Okay, now to today's show. Publishers send me books all the time in order to interest me in talking with their authors. And it's funny, after 20-plus years, I still get the occasional novel, even though I could count on one hand the number of novelists I've had on the show. But when I received the latest book by today's guest, I set it aside. It was a book of essays, and how do you interview a book of essays? I've appreciated Hochschild's work over the years, but like so many people today, I was looking for a reason to say no. You know, we get too many choices, too many options. Set that aside. And I sat on my bookshelf for months, but I often say that I interview people, not books or work. And as soon as I finally picked up Lessons from a Dark Time, I wanted to have this conversation with Adam Hochschild. As a writer, he does not waste your time. He brings an artist's touch and a moralist conscience to the issues and events he grapples with. He was one of the founders of Mother Jones magazine in 1976, so he's been at this a long time. And one of my favorite conversations since the 2016 election was with Adam's wife. I mentioned her before, Arlie Hochschild, about her book Strangers in Their Own Land. And we talked about the need for a story that could move some Americans to yearn for the future rather than the past. And I look forward to touching on that with Adam as well. In Lessons from a Dark Time, he selected and updated over two dozen essays and pieces of reporting that he's done over the years. Threading through them all is his concern for social justice and the people who fight for it. And the articles range from a California gun show to a Finnish prison, from a Congolese center for rape victims to the ruins of gulag camps in the Soviet Arctic, from a stroll through construction sites with an ecological architect in India to a day on the campaign trail with Nelson Mandela. And also one that he was actually peripherally involved with, which was the CIA domination of the National Student Organization back in the 60s. Adam Hochschild teaches at the Graduate School of Journalism, UC Berkeley. He was a reporter for the San Francisco Chronicle, a commentator on NPR's All Things Considered. His articles have also been published in Mother Jones, New Yorker, Harper's, The Atlantic, The New York Times Magazine, and others. He's the author of 9 books, including King Leopold's Ghost, Spain in Our Hearts, and his latest, Lessons from a Dark Time and Other Essays. Welcome, Adam Hochschild, to Freeform, A World That Just Might Work.
Well, thank you, Terrence. It's good to be with you, and I'm glad you ran through that list of activist websites and so forth. We need people to do that kind of work today.
Exactly. And it takes a couple of minutes, but if someone, you know, is at that moment when they're looking, when they're asking a question, which I think people have definitely all been asking since the 2016 election, which is, what can I do? Maybe this is the way that we'll direct them. I also want to tell listeners that we're recording this conversation Wednesday, the 28th of August. As I said in that intro, Adam, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we're going to talk about. So can you tell your story briefly about your path to the work that you do today? And so that they get a sense of you, I'm really fine with you going way back, mentors, turning points, moments of decision. We've got time.
Well, we got about 10 hours or so. You know, I think when it comes to what kinds of things I like to write about and so forth, the most important thing in my life is that I came of age in the 1960s. I was 18 years old when John F. Kennedy was elected president. I sort of came to political awareness in the years following that. When I was in college, the civil rights movement was revived, and people around me were going off on freedom rides to the South. In 1964, my then-girlfriend, now wife, Arlie, and I went briefly to Mississippi as civil rights workers. And then, like all young people at that time, you know, I was faced with the question of the Vietnam War, the draft. Are you going to let yourself be drafted to fight in this war, or are you going to resist it or avoid it in some way? So I think being born at a time when I came of age in that decade affected me profoundly. Had I come of age in the 1950s, heaven knows, you know, I might have become a lawyer or an investment banker or something like that. But coming of age in the 1960s, it just seemed a time when all around me, in different ways, people were becoming aware of the injustices of the world that we were living in. The brutal, senseless war that the United States was fighting in Vietnam. The horrendous way in which the promise of liberation with the end of slavery in the United States had not been fulfilled. And throughout the American South, black people were being prevented from voting. Jim Crow continued, and there were people trying to stop that and change it. It was an exciting time. I think an experience that also had a tremendous impact on me, which I've written about in earlier books, was that one summer when I was in college, the summer of 1962, I spent working on an anti-apartheid newspaper in South Africa. This was, you know, at the beginning of a long period of repression in South Africa, the apartheid years. A number of the people I worked with had been in prison or subsequently went to prison. One guy I got to know quite well was later hanged. And it was a life-changing experience for me because I saw the tremendous injustices there and realized that essentially the United States was on the wrong side and was a de facto backer of the apartheid regime. And I think that gave me a set of political eyes with which were not surprised to find us doing the wrong thing in Vietnam as well. So those were some of the experiences, I think, which made me who I turned out to be as a writer.
And you wrote a book, I think it was your first book, Half the Way Home, which was a memoir in your relationship with your father and the politics it involved. I'm going to ask you about that. But first, I mentioned in the intro that I almost never interview novelists, and I think it's just a matter of, you know, not having enough time. I think if I did this show every day, I certainly would. But you were a novelist yourself, weren't you?
Well, not really. I wrote an unpublished novel, which I worked on very hard for a long time. Actually had a contract with a publisher to do it and was thrilled. I felt that certified me as a novelist. And then I was shocked and horrified when I turned in the novel at the age of about 30 or so that the publisher decided they didn't want to publish it. And I felt that a great felony had been committed against American literature. But as time passed, I looked at it and I realized, well, you know, it maybe isn't such a great book after all. And then years later, about 15 years later, I ended up writing my first book to be published, which was the one you mentioned, Half the Way Home, which was a memoir. And after it was published, I one point pulled out the manuscript of the novel and realized, hey, that was a first draft of my memoir. It had never occurred to me before. You know, the people in the novel were quite different from me. The central character was a woman, but the emotions involved and so forth, I think, were what I was dealing with in my memoir. So, yeah, I would love to be a novelist, but I've not really tried seriously since then. I think that's going to have to wait for my next life.
Yeah, and the memoir I mentioned was a relationship with your father and the politics it involved. Your father, it seemed, had a bit of a paradox in his life, yes, no, in what he did and what he cared about?
That's true. He was an executive of a multinational mining company that had mines in Africa. And I gradually realized that it was, you know, this was the business which, you know, paid for our quite comfortable lifestyle, for my being able to go to college with all my tuition paid, for living quite well here, that it was all based on, you know, the labor of Africans working far under the earth, not being paid very much in very hot, damp, sometimes dangerous conditions. This was what was paying for my life. And in a way, that was kind of a lesson in the basics of how the world works, mm-hmm. the relationship between the world's south and the world's north, the poor countries and the rich countries. And it's been kind of a lens through which I have seen the world ever since then. It's taken me back to Africa a number of times, the last time just about 6 months ago, writing newspaper and magazine pieces, and in a couple of cases books about what I saw there. My father was a paradoxical person, as you say, because even though he was in this role as executive of this multinational mining company, he was actually someone of extremely liberal politics. And people of my age will remember that President Nixon had an enemies list of people mm-hmm. who crossed him in one way or another, that he wanted the IRS to gather information on and so forth. And my father was on Nixon's enemies list because he was a staunch and outspoken opponent of the war in Vietnam. And he felt quite proud to be on Nixon's enemies list. So there were some political things on which we very much agreed.
Okay. I want to talk about your writing process a bit. And I'm going to read a couple of things that I've read that you've said. One is, work is hard, distractions are plentiful, time is short. another is that it takes you anywhere between 3 to 6 years working pretty much full-time to write a book. How do you choose your subjects, or do they choose you? And then what is your process like?
Well, big questions. how do I choose my subjects? Well, you know, if you're going to write a book, at least the kind of heavily research-based nonfiction books that I usually do, it does usually take me somewhere between 3 and 6 years. And you can only do that kind of work if you are really obsessed and fascinated by something, if a subject possesses you in some way. Now, the great problem I have is that the subjects that deeply obsess and fascinate me usually do so because somebody has written a very good book about it. And so my task is to find a pathway, a different pathway into the subject. And sometimes that takes a long time. For example, the book that took me 6 years was a book about the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
That's a mighty big subject, and you have to figure out how to narrow it down.
And then, as I've heard you say, how many books have already been written about that?
Right. I mean, when I went to the Interlibrary Card Catalog to look that up, when I was first starting on the project, I found 120,000 separate titles about the First World War. Now, only about 80,000 of them were in English, which reduces the competition a little bit. But still, how do you find a fresh pathway into it? Well, I knew, I mean, let's just take that book, To End mm-hmm. All Wars is its title. It appeared in 2011. I knew the things that fascinated me, and they were two quite disparate things. One was the boneheaded generals who conducted that war, who week after week, month after month, year after year, ordered these poor young soldiers to climb out of their trenches and walk, not run, not crawl, but walk towards the enemy trench so that they could be shot down in large numbers. And those tactics didn't change for most of the war. Who were these guys who sent them into battle? What formed them? What life experiences made them into people who could fight a war that way? That was one thing that intrigued me. The other thing that intrigued me were the people who, at the time, understood that this war was complete madness, that it would remake the world for the worse in every way, and as a consequence, refused to fight, or if they were not men of draft age, you know, supported those who refused to fight. I couldn't, for the longest time, figure out how to get these two very disparate types of characters into the same book. I didn't want to do a series of portraits of the generals and then a series of portraits of the pacifists. Couldn't figure it out. And then one day, and I'm about a year and a half into the process at this point, reading, taking notes, and so on, suddenly I saw a path, and that was this. I was reading a very boringly written scholarly article about a well-known British woman pacifist named Charlotte Despard, who was a strong opponent of the war, an ardent radical in every way, favored independence for India, independence for Ireland, was arrested 4 times in the battle for women's suffrage. And in one sentence in passing, the writer of this article said, naturally, Mrs. Despard's activities were deeply upsetting to her brother. And it gave his name, Sir John French, which I recognized as British Commander-in-Chief on the Western Front. So I thought, wow, that's going to be an interesting relationship to explore. And then suddenly, you know, a flash of enlightenment went off in my head, and I realized, divided families, that's how I'm going to tell this story. And I know all about divided families because all around me during the Vietnam War in the United States, families were divided over the war, with usually the young people opposing it and the old backing it. So then I was off and running.
Mm-hmm.
But it took another 4.5 years to to put the book together.
Now, I was lucky enough to listen to an interview that you did at the School of Journalism at Berkeley on the newest book, and you went more into your process. And I remember the person who was interviewing you, a fellow of yours at the journalism school, I believe, was also quite surprised by what you said. And you said you actually can graph or do graph your books. Now let's tell people we're talking about probably a nonfiction book, probably about a historical period, probably finding the way in as you just described, but then you talked about this process where you actually graph the book. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I like to draw diagrams of things. And when I teach writing, I do this. I will try to express I think any piece of writing that really works has a structure to it. It's got a backbone. You know, a body doesn't stand up unless it has a skeleton. But you can't see the skeleton. I think if you're trying to figure out what makes a book work, why did it hold my interest for 300 pages? Why did a 5,000-word magazine article keep me turning the pages? There's a structure there. There are, teasers put out, suspenseful moments where the answer to the suspenseful question isn't given, and you keep reading trying to find that answer. There are people introduced in different ways that then later meet and find each other. Any novel, any Shakespeare play has got structure behind it. I love to try to represent that graphically on paper with lines and arrows and little things that look like a cliff where there's a moment of suspense. And I need to draw some sort of map like that for whatever book that I write, or even an article that I write, so I can kind of see what the structure is and see how I'm going to draw the reader through it. It gets complicated when you're manipulating a large cast of characters. In To End All Wars, the First World War book we were talking about, you know, there are about a dozen principal characters, socially high and low, you know, field marshals and generals and ordinary privates who get into trouble or become war resistors or whatever. I want to know who's on stage at what time, how are they going to appear in the next scene? And I think a lot of writers do this kind of thing in one way or another, whether they represent it graphically or not. I once read that the playwright George Bernard Shaw, when he was writing a play, used little slips of paper on his desk to represent which of his characters were on stage at a particular point. And so I think, a lot of us who write nonfiction end up doing some sort of similar process.
Yeah, let me just respond to that in a couple of ways. One is that I think for some people this is probably a bit of a revelation. You know, I would think maybe in a play, maybe in a movie, we've all seen all those books and seminars on, you know, Act 1, Act 2, Act 3 in movies, but to think that someone doing nonfiction work is doing this as well, I think is interesting. And so what you talk about there is, you were talking about the suspense. And I was in the entertainment industry, wrote movies and things, and now I teach some storytelling and narrative, mostly to nonprofits and foundations and so on. And so I'm always looking for definitions of story, and someone actually said, it's a story if you keep having to ask what happens next.
Exactly. And you know from your experience in the movie industry that people always, filmmakers always talk about Act 1, Act 2, Act 3. And when I first heard this years and years ago, I thought, hey, that's strange. I didn't see any labels on the screen. You know, Act 1 begins now, Act 2 begins. But then you look at movies and you realize, most of them do fall into a kind of a pattern like that, where Act 1, the basic dilemma, is laid out. Act 2, there are sort of complications, and Act 3, you learn, you know, how things finally work out. And, you know, I think if we nonfiction writers want people to read our books, we've got to make them as suspenseful, in storytelling terms, as a movie is. The difference, though, is in nonfiction or history, you're playing by other rules. You can't invent anything. Everything has to be documented, factually accurate, footnoted in the case of my books, and so forth. But, you know, life still gives you a lot of material to work with.
Right, right. And the other thing that you make very clear is that scenes are essential. And some people might think, oh, it's nonfiction. It's, you know, it's telling why things happened. But without scenes, it becomes an essay and not a story, right?
Exactly. I mean, our life unfolds in scenes. All through the day, you have encounters with people. You go to meetings. You have an argument with somebody. You go to a class where there are all kinds of dynamics going on. You know, life exists in scenes, and so do movies, plays, novels. You know, a movie wouldn't be very exciting if it was just a narrator describing things, and then you see pictures of a landscape or something in the background. And I feel it's the same way for, you know, a good nonfiction book or a good book of history that's going to hold somebody's attention. You want scenes. You want places where people are encountering each other, especially in conflict. You want people encountering each other and falling in love or falling out of love. And if life is full of this, and happily, there's a lot of evidence out there that allows you to construct those scenes. Letters, diaries, memoirs, or for public events, you know, accounts by reporters who were on the scene.
Yeah, and I think that one thing that when I will talk to a bunch of people, let's say they work at a nonprofit and they're trying to figure out how to, I'm saying, you know, you got to learn how to tell stories about the impact your organization's having, right? And they fumble a lot of times to find those. Lately, I was doing a workshop around Christmas. So I thought, oh, let's see if I can refer to the Christmas Carol, right? The Dickens story. So I look at that because it's something everyone knows, it's powerful and so on. And what I found was that when the ghost goes back, or when the ghost takes Scrooge to past, present, and future, he doesn't tell a whole story. You see a marketplace with people busily preparing for a feast. You see a young man and a young woman sort of falling in love. You see, and I realize that you don't need even the whole scene for people to get what's going on. And I've begun to say, can you, instead of asking them, can you think of a story? I just say, can you think of a scene of impact at your, you know, at your organization? And then the story will reveal itself. But the scene is something which we're much more likely, I think, to remember like that.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, the Christmas Carol, in the Bay Area, where I live most of the year, the San Francisco American Conservatory Theater does a version of the Christmas Carol as a play, and every year we take our grandchildren, and we've now got them interested in how each year's production differs from the last, and so forth. Yeah, it's you know, the scenes and things that suggest a scene or
even
a scene.
Yeah.
Sometimes that's all you need.
Yeah. By the way, I'm an alumnus of ACT.
Really?
Yeah, 1974. I went to the conservatory there. The other thing that you talk about, and this is something that Michael Lewis, for instance, talks about a great deal, and Michael Lewis sells a ton of books, and Gladwell and Ira Glass both say he's their favorite storyteller, is he will do tons of research, but until he can find the characters and the voices that are going to carry it, he doesn't have it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. No, that's totally true for me, too. I need characters through whom I can tell a story. You know, people are not going to pay attention otherwise. There's certainly, you know, all sorts of fine scholarship about various pieces of history that isn't written in that manner. But if you want to reach, you know, large numbers of people, I think you have to find ways of bringing people into the story.
Yeah, yeah. And it'll be, I mean, with Lewis, and I think in your work as well, it won't be necessarily the person everyone knew about when this event was taking place, not the person that was in the headlines necessarily, not the person that the public or the press thinks is driving it. The more interesting voice in Lewis's, it's usually somebody who's off kilter a little bit. In yours, it's as you said, in the World War One, it's the people who were driving the war and the people who were opposing it, you know.
Right. And I'd like to think that even for somebody who's read a dozen books on the First World War, most of the characters in my book, they will not be people that they've heard of.
Exactly, exactly.
You know, there's no excitement in writing about people about whom a great deal has been written. You'll never catch me writing a book about the Founding Fathers, for example.
hats off to the people who do.
Yeah, you know, some people do it and do it very well. But I'd rather find, you know, if I'm writing about that time, some group of people whom you haven't heard about.
Right.
And make you interested in them.
Right. Well, for one thing, since you're writing about history, that helps the suspense.
Mm-hmm.
If it's the story they all heard in fifth grade, not so much suspense there. I want to tell people this is Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work. I'm Terrence McNally, and I'm speaking with Adam Hochschild. He's a journalism professor at UC Berkeley, author most recently of Lessons from a Dark Time and other essays. And you can learn more at journalism.berkeley.edu and then search for Adam Hochschild, and that's Hochschild. I want to turn, because it is the opening essay in Lessons from a Dark Time, and I think it's the one from which the book gets its name, which is the period during and after World War One. And I want to put it to you this way. I recently interviewed T-Bone Burnett, the music producer, and it wasn't about his music. It was about his South by Southwest keynote, in which he, Fast Company called it a scorching keynote, about what has been termed recently surveillance capitalism. The capitalism practiced by big tech, in which the service is free, we are the product, the data is being used, to sell us things and move our minds and our neurotransmitters in ways we'll never discover. And in it, he mentions Bernays' work for Wilson.
Mm-hmm.
Bernays is the nephew of Sigmund Freud and the inventor of public relations.
Right.
He coined the term. Up till then, it had been called what it is, which is propaganda.
Yep.
So Bernays is working for Wilson, and he wants to sell World War One. And they had, it seems to me, they had two slogans. One was the war to end all wars, and the other the war to make the world safe for democracy. And I couldn't help but see the links between the present and that past when I read what you were writing about Wilson's racist fear-mongering. So could you talk about that and in reference to today?
Sure. Well, that period in American history, and we're talking really from early 1917 when the U.S. entered the First World War, for really the next 3 years, is a time that has long fascinated me. It figures in the title essay of this book. It's actually also has a place in a book of mine that's coming out in March, and I'm even now trying to think of a way to write a history of that period, although I haven't yet fully got the characters with which to do it. It was indeed a very dark time in this country, and I see a lot of echoes of things that we're experiencing, actually in somewhat milder form today, bad as things sometimes seem. When the United States entered the First World War in the spring of 1917, it ticked off a kind of spurt of xenophobia here, the likes of which I don't think this country had ever seen. Suddenly, Germany was the enemy. People with German names changed their names. Families named Schmidt became Smith. You know, cities named Germantown changed their name to something else. German books were burned in public bonfires. Schools, colleges, universities stopped teaching the German language. I heard a little bit about this growing up because my father grew up in a household where they spoke German. His parents were German-speaking Jews. His father was actually an immigrant from Germany. They spoke German at home, but they were terrified to do so on the street during this period, 1917, 1918. And my father was desperate to try to get into the military because having a uniform was sort of a certification of your patriotism. There were people who were seized on the street and beaten up, or in one famous case, lynched because they were German-born, and this was something considered very suspicious. There was a spy mania. You know, government agencies were flooded with tens of thousands of reports of people suspected of being German spies or saboteurs or whatever, 99% of them complete balderdash. Then that xenophobia very quickly switched to all things Russian after the Russian Revolution happened. The Bolshevik seizure of power late 1917 terrified the American establishment because they were afraid of it spreading to the United States. You know, in Russia, the communists who'd taken power, you know, were nationalizing industries and land and so forth, and people were afraid of doing that the same thing would happen here. So there was a nationwide crackdown on the left. There had been a long, stormy period of a decade or so of labor violence in the United States, widespread strikes that were often brutally suppressed by the National Guard. The war and the Russian Revolution gave business and the government sort of the excuse to make an all-out war on organized labor in a form that hadn't quite existed before. And the repression that took place was really quite extraordinary. The organization that those in power were most afraid of was the Wobblies, the Industrial Workers of the World, IWW, which was the country's most militant union, and they crushed it. There were nationwide raids on every Wobbly office in the country. More than 100 leading Wobblies were put in sealed freight cars, and brought to Chicago for the largest mass trial that's ever taken place in American history, more than 100 defendants. It ran for 4 months in the spring and summer of 1918. All 101 defendants were found guilty on all counts and sentenced to a total of more than 800 years of prison time. And that organization was crushed. So there was a real nastiness in the air, which continued. The famous Palmer raid, mm-hmm, 1919, early 1920, an estimated 10,000 people arrested, roughed up, beaten up, treated very roughly because they were people who were thought to be members or sympathizers of the new Communist Party, actually two rival Communist parties that had started here in the wake of the Russian Revolution. And something that's a kind of echo of today, what the authorities were trying to do was to find people among all these folks who got arrested who could be deported because they were aliens who had never become U.S. citizens, and that would make them eligible for deportation. So there was a kind of mania for deporting people, which, of course, we're all too familiar with today. So these were just some of the things, not to mention widespread press censorship that happened during this very, very dark time.
And you say that Wilson kept his image as an above-the-fray idealist by outsourcing the inflammatory rhetoric to Elihu Root, someone whose name sounds vaguely familiar. But you have a quote from him speaking to an audience at New York's Union League Club in August 1917. "There are men," this is a quote, "there are men walking about the streets of this city tonight who ought to be taken out at sunrise tomorrow and shot for treason. There are some newspapers published in the city every day, the editors of which deserve conviction and execution for treason." This was not some crank. Elihu Root was a big deal.
That's right. Elihu Root was sort of the prototype of the so-called wise men of American foreign policy. People, Wall Street lawyer who sort of floated back and forth between the New York business world and Washington, where he had been Secretary of State, Secretary of War, Senator from New York, and when he said that amazing quote that you just read, he was a special emissary of Woodrow Wilson, who had just returned from a trip to Russia. And, you know, he was not the only one saying crazy things like that. It sort of gives you a sense of how much madness was in the air then.
Mm-hmm.
Woodrow Wilson, who was president, is somebody that we remember as a sort of internationalist idealist because he wanted the United States to join the League of Nations, and the League of Nations was kind of his idea. But he presided over an administration where a lot of very nasty stuff went on.
Yeah, no, I was going to say that the Wilson of history class, not necessarily if you get as far as studying him in college, but if you go through that grade school and then that high school history, Wilson is, you know, I'm telling you, my experience, he was like in that next tier just below Mount Rushmore.
That's right.
And in fact, we have the anti-immigrant, we have the free rein to this sort of stuff, 75 newspapers and magazines either closed or had issues banned, and racist.
Mm-hmm.
He's the one who played Birth of a Nation at the White House, right?
Right. You know, he was an ardent segregationist. He was from Virginia, a Southerner. He brought many Southerners into his cabinet. The federal government had made some timid steps in the direction of desegregating the federal bureaucracy and civil service. Wilson resegregated it. And, you know, he was terrible on the issue of race, on the issue of immigration. And, you know, he represented something that was quite widespread in the United States at that time, I think, which was that really since colonial days, the United States and the 13 colonies before then had been run by essentially an Anglo-Saxon elite. And these were folks whose ancestors came from the British Isles, pretty much. They had run the country, but starting in the 1880s and especially after 1890, the immigrants coming to the United States came mostly from Southern and Eastern Europe. You know, Italians, Jews, Russians, Greeks, other Slavs. And this old Anglo-Saxon elite was very alarmed by this. They felt they were losing ground in the country to all these very foreign-looking people speaking foreign languages who were arriving here. And I think that fueled some of the anti-immigrant hysteria, which, of course, culminated in the very restrictive Immigration Act of 1924, where they set quotas extremely restrictive quotas on how many immigrants could come to the U.S. from what countries. And those quotas were based not on what the ancestors ancestry of the population of the U.S. was at that time, but rather what it had been in 1890.
Right, 30 years earlier.
Before this wave of Southern and Eastern Europeans started to come.
Yeah. I mean, I see that very, you know, that certainly we see echoes of that in our time. And the speaking of echoes, you caution, I know, and it certainly has been, you know, you and I are not the only ones who worry about this, that what you mentioned that you feel the time under Wilson was worse, they were darker than now, but one could say that the difference was war, and that because there was a war, they could push everything a little further. And so our greatest fear, I think, during the next year and a half of Trump is that he doesn't pull that same card.
Right. I think that is a big thing to worry about. And I also fear that somebody may hand him that card if there's something like, you know, like the September 11th attacks that happens again.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Trump's going to eat that up. That's just the kind of thing that he wants. It's going to give him an excuse to put through all sorts of repressive measures. Let's hope nobody hands him that opportunity.
Okay, I have two other sort of big questions that I think we'll have time to get to. We've got about 10 minutes left. One is just, and this is not because you've written about this, but just because I know that you think about these sorts of things. Something that has occurred to me recently is that, and you were formed, our difference in age is like half a decade, I think. And so you say you were formed by the 60s. I say I was formed by the 60s. You went through the, you know, that much older than I was. But I like entered college 65, graduated 69. Mm-hmm. Where that generation helped end a war to make, and they helped make a corrupt president resign. But I feel like this generation has lost its way in such terrible ways that, let me pose this to you. I think we have been really inadequate stewards of democracy, and that authoritarianism has real advantages when confronting big problems that call for rapid pivots and mobilization, and that what FDR could do during World War II to mobilize and sustain our war effort, China can do every day because they're an authoritarian government. And that unless democracy becomes a more successful force for good in confronting climate change, that China will seize the mantle, lead the world, hopefully save the planet. But it seems to me there's more at stake here than just whether human society survives, but also how that human society organizes itself moving forward if we successfully confront climate change. Any thoughts about that?
Boy, big question. I must say, I think that on a country-by-country basis, some of the countries that have done the best in taking climate change really seriously actually, I think, have been small democracies.
Mm-hmm.
The new government in Finland, Denmark, which has a huge amount of wind power, Norway, Sweden, that part of the world, Germany. You know, those countries take climate change a lot more seriously than we do. The Chinese, it seems to me, you know, they know that it's happening, and they have become world leaders in the manufacture of things like solar panels and windmills. But at the same time, they are still building new coal-powered coal-fired power plants at quite a clip.
Well, actually not so much in China anymore. That's slowed down greatly. They are building them more in their Belt and Road thing around the world.
Mm-hmm. I mean, all of us are still so incredibly linked to this carbon-based economy. You know, you just have to walk out the door anywhere in the United States and look at the number of cars zipping by. The thing that I think we haven't figured out there is how do you get countries some of which are going to be democracies and some of which are going to be dictatorships, working together on this and agreeing that, you know, what the smoke and carbon and so forth that we put in the air here has an effect on the other side of the world. The carbon that they put in the air there, you know, has an effect here. We have not yet figured out a way to work together and to share the sacrifices that may have to be made. I suppose it is simpler in a dictatorship if you want to really take this seriously, but there are a lot of dictatorships around the world that are doing nothing on
exactly. I mean, just we could look at, although it isn't a dictatorship, it's certainly a strongman government, what's happening with Bolsonaro in Brazil right this moment.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know.
How do you characterize a country like that, which is sort of halfway between a democracy and a dictatorship?
Yeah, yeah. Okay, here's the final sort of big one, which is the one that I alluded to at the top and one that I spent some time when I was interviewing your wife in 2017, Arlie Hochschild, which is that soon after the 2016 election, I came across a quote from Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, the writer of The Little Prince.
Mm-hmm.
And the quote, I don't even know what it's from, but really struck me. It says, if you want to build a ship, don't drum up the men to gather wood, divide the work, and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. Okay? And I apply that to where we are as a country. And how do we do that in 2019? The passion to return to a simpler past drove enough crucial voters to the polls in swing states to decide the 2016 presidential election. How do we engage those emotions? Some of them. I know some people are just, that's who they're going to be. That's how they're going to vote. It's become their identity. How do we move some of them into a more positive, forward-thinking, progressive direction? In talking with Arlie about this, she suggested maybe it's the age-old American image of the frontier, that there is a frontier of how we confront climate change, how we deal with technological disruption, how we, you know, those sorts of things. Any thoughts about what story, we talked a lot about story, what story, what narrative can galvanize people to, as I say, look toward the future and yearn for taking on those challenges versus wanting to slip back into the past?
It's a tough one. I think, you know, climate is the huge challenge. There is no question about that. And I think some of the good folks working on that have made the analogy to, you know, look what the United States did in World War II. I think that's a good one. You know, in the 3.5 years we were in the war, you know, the U.S. completely reoriented its economy. There was some belt tightening that was required here at home, but we, you know, turned out the stuff, the weaponry and so forth that was necessary to help win that war. I think we need to find ways of making people feel that kind of urgency and that kind of moral urgency. It's hard because there isn't a figure like Hitler,
mm-hmm.
Who can easily be the embodiment of all evil. But, you know, we need to find ways of creating a kind of moral urgency there. I think younger people are much more interested in this than older people. There was an interesting thing in the news a few weeks ago where there was an organization of young Republicans that were
mm-hmm.
trying to press the party to take the issue of climate change more seriously. I think it's partly a generational thing. I also see some hope of, you know, if there is a Democratic presidential candidate who can really talk frankly and honestly about the enormous disparities of wealth in this country, I think that's something that will, to some extent, reach across the divide. When Arlie was doing her research in Louisiana among Tea Party voters there, one of the things she found that surprised her was that a lot of them were quite friendly towards Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm.
They felt that you know they didn't go along with him on a lot of things. These are people who care passionately, you know, about abortion and so forth, but they sympathized with him in a way that they in no way did with Hillary Clinton. So I'm glad to see Bernie and Elizabeth Warren rising in the polls. I think, you know, whoever becomes the candidate is going to have to talk about the unfairness of the economy in the way that they do, and that is possibly something that could reach out to a much wider group of people.
Yeah, So climate change and the enormous challenge that is, and can that tap into sort of this American can-do spirit on that one? And then, yeah, obviously inequality, and if people can see that Trump and his folks are not on your side, you know, that they were right in the diagnosis. But way wrong in the treatment.
Yeah.
And that there are some moral notions there about inequality, and I think also about cheating, cutting corners, enriching yourself stiffing your contractors, all those sorts of things. I think there's some of that that I think hits some deep American chords as well.
Yeah.
Okay, so again, the book is Lessons from a Dark Time. The website is journalism.berkeley.edu, and then search for Adam Hochschild, Hochschild. For this conversation and many other interviews, articles, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, you can go to terrencemcnally.net or worldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. If you want to get my weekly email announcement that tells you who's going to be on what we're going to talk about, and usually 8 or 10 articles that flesh out the conversation, sign up at my site or email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Freeform podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. You can find years of podcasts at my site, that's terrencemcnally.net, or at those other podcast sites. Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, Greg Boyle. You can follow me on Twitter at McNally-Terrence. Thanks to Kiana Williams in production and to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices. And most of all to you, my listeners, please share this podcast widely. And finally, thank you, Adam Hochschild, and keep up the good work.
Well, thank you, Terrence. It's been a real pleasure talking to you. I don't know if we've solved all the problems in the world, but maybe we've made some steps forward.
Very good. And also a little bit on how to talk about them, how to write about them, that as well.
As the PV audience has grown, so have our bandwidth costs. We've tried to protect the limited commercial nature of the stream, so to keep up with the costs, we need your help. You might say we're victims of our own success. With nearly 1 million regular listeners now, the cost of operating the stream has grown beyond our wildest expectations. If you want to continue enjoying all the great shows on the free mobile Progressive Voices platform, please pitch in now. Go to progressivevoices.com and press the donate button.
Whether you're listening to me, Mark Levine, every Thursday,
or me, Leslie Marshall, each Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday,
you can hear us from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Voices Network.
Here's a sample of what you'll hear. President Trump also savaged his hand-picked Federal Reserve chairman, slamming Jerome Powell as an enemy who could pose a bigger risk to the U.S. than Chinese President Xi Jinping. As usual, he said, the Fed did nothing. It is incredible that they can speak without knowing or asking what I'm doing, which will be announced shortly. We have a very strong dollar and a very weak Fed. I will work brilliantly with both, and the U.S. will do great. And the president added, my only question is, who is our biggest enemy? Jay Powell or Chairman Xi.
What?
And that refers to the Chinese leader, and Trump even misspelled Powell's name in his initial tweet before correcting it. Not surprising coming from the president, the comment, or the misspelling. Let's rip another.
Again, that's Mark Levine every Thursday.
And Leslie Marshall each Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday.
3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Voices Network.